With protests against racial injustice happening across the nation, we sat down with community activists helping organize individuals in Bowling Green. Sitting under a pavilion at Kariakas Park last week, we asked members of the Bowling Green Freedom Walkers and Bowling Green for Peace, as well as State Representative Patty Minter, about where they feel the summer goes from here. For WKU Public Radio and NPR One, I'm Colin Jackson.
Derek Overstreet.
Karika Nelson.
Representative Patty Minter.
Megan Bailey.
Right now, the big thing is just to get people to accept that there are issues and to get to recognize that stuff needs to be changed. And that's happening right now. But to continue this, we can't just be out in the street screaming. We can't just be raising scenes. We have to continue that direct communication. That's the only way forward. And you have to keep it going or it collapses off and fades away.
What this Bowling Green movement is doing is pulling people together that have to be part of the conversation. The grassroots groups that are lifting up black voices have done so in ways that have demanded attention, done so in a peaceful way, but also included people who have to be part of that conversation in order for structural change to happen. One of the things that makes the Bowling Green movement different than some of the other movements around the state is that, you know, the police, the Bowling Green Police Department and the Warren County Sheriff's Department have been part of the conversation since day one, and that's great. You know, they've done a great job of understanding that they need to be at the table, they need to be part of that conversation, and that change has to come from, you know, from them. And that's wonderful, because in other cities, getting to that same point has taken weeks. So again, I think it speaks to the incredible organizing that young organizers have done in Bowling Green, and it speaks to the fact that our law enforcement recognizes that there need to be changes, the community is calling for them, and they're ready to sit down at the table and have those conversations.
I think we have the momentum, the younger generation. Like, I feel like we all want to do something, even if we don't know what we should or ought to do. I mean, I think we all have power in the numbers of the people to make a change. We just don't know what to do. I think we've been on the backs of Martin Luther King my whole life, and I'm 30, that we see how peaceful he was and how he tried to use city officials as allies, but we don't really know the whole process, you know what I'm saying? So with me, it's a learning experience by working with city officials, the police, my team, Derek with his group, just trying to brainstorm ideas on how we can implement change and make Bowling Green a better place. To me, it's about awareness and not about our skin color. Over 400 years, I feel like that's the least of our worries. So I think that the momentum is going to carry throughout the whole summer. So.
What the past history of social movements teaches us, and the struggle for black freedom teaches us, is that the work is never done. It's ongoing. And, you know, to me, as a historian and as an activist and as a legislator, my question is this our freedom summer? 1964 was freedom summer, when everything came together all over the country and young people went to Mississippi and organized for change, and they did it in a lot of different ways. They had actions, they knocked doors, they went door to door organizing people to stand up for their right to vote. They sent people to the, you know, grassroots, people from Mississippi, sent them to the Democratic National Convention to change the conversation at the platform. So, you know, is this freedom summer? Oh, I hope so, because we need that. This is the moment that we can change the conversation in America, and I'm proud to stand alongside young people, young black people, who are making this happen in the streets, but later on in the committee meetings, in the rooms where those decisions are made, and that's the less emotional but equally necessary work.
Well, it's understanding that though we did have activists, we did have Dr. King, we did have even Charles Niblett, but it's understanding that we stand on their shoulders, that the fight is still, it still continues, but how long are we gonna live their dream? Now, we build a new situation, and we continue that fight, we carry on that mantle, we take that fire, and we move it along as the new activists of this era, you know, and it's I understand my history, but I also understand that they fought their fight. They fought the good fight. They made it possible for me to be able to even sit at this table and have this conversation. So now it's my job to make it possible for my kids and their kids and their kids. I'm the one who implements the next 200 years worth of law. And it's understanding that as we continue on in this fight.
Everything's still brand new. I mean, we're learning on the job as it goes, but it's going pretty well with all these people jumping on ship like this. I've never seen anything like it. People from different classes and races all coming out at the same time to support the same thing out of nowhere. Like, we've literally existed for probably about a week, both of us. And to have that amount of support and that kind of turnout overnight is different. It feels really different. And it'd be a good thing to keep this going for multiple years, even past this. I think it's going to run past the summer. I think it'll run through the election, probably into early next year. And then it'll be a thing of staying stable and keeping continually working for change. But yeah, it doesn't feel like a summer thing. It feels like at this point, it feels like I'm here for life. But you can't really start something like this and then jump off the ship.
It's about putting truth in office, yeah.
Once you step, not just money. Once you step out like this, it's, you're in. And you should be in because that's the right people that are involved. And I think it'll keep running. It'll keep going.
And we have the blueprint. The blueprint is there. It's about seeing the blueprint, recognizing the blueprint, and then being willing to listen to those generations that have done this before. Those people that have already done these marches, and they're 60 and 70 and 80 and 90, and they're willing to talk to us. It's about not pushing them away and acting as though their contribution doesn't matter. Sit down and have those conversations and get that encouraging word. They're behind us. They just want to be helpful. And it's about moving forward into legislation, having real people, real residents, real citizens in these office seats rather than people that could pay to be there. Mm-hmm. There's a difference.
Oh, yes, there is. That's right. Grassroots. And, you know, that's what brought me to office. My background is teaching history about civil rights and human rights, but also in nonviolent direct action through the fairness movement. I'm one of the founding members of the Bowling Green Fairness Movement, and we sat in and will continue doing so when City Commission is open to the public again. We sat in nonviolent direct action for years, and a lot of the people who have been participating in the Black freedom struggle here, other social movements here, a lot of the people that I saw last Friday night at Circus Square Park are people who sat in for fairness. You know, so we see that they, you know, people understand that it's not, you don't go to one meeting and you pat yourself on your back and you say, real good, I went to a protest, check that box and I'm done. You know, this is ongoing work.
Well, we have to understand that even with you being there, you shouldn't have to do it alone. So it takes a group, because what a lot of people want is they want immediate change, and they don't understand that there's a vetting system. Not just anybody can decide to pick up and run. You have to be qualified. There's goals in mind, yes, but there's a process to get there. This is chess, not checkers. So that means that everybody in that room, there has to be a division there of some sort that's more fair. If you have one or two people in the room that are truly fighting for the residents of their area, but then you got another 10 or 15 that have no interest, then how fair can we really be? It's about really getting into that room. That way we can begin to persuade and sway that anchor there. You can't, it's hard to be as persuasive, you know, sitting at home. They can hear your opinions all day, but those smiles can turn into something totally different when they go into that room on Monday to vote. And you need to be in there. You need to make your voice heard and keep your face shown to be a true game changer.
You can't do all your, you can't just keep talking about it sitting at home.
Getting all of the community out to vote, that's where it's gonna start. Getting the right people in the offices. I know it's kind of hard, like just learning with politics, but everybody that smiles in your face, like Megan said, is not on your side. They might be out there to look pretty and, you know, hey, Black Lives Matter, but on Monday morning, when we have a list of demands and we send it to whoever, they're gonna be the first person that's gonna not vote on it. So we gotta vote the right people in that really care about the movement, that really care about the people, that really care about fairness, about social, any type of discrimination, about implementing change. We gotta get those right people in office, from city to state to federal office.
So voting is vital.
But yeah, voting is vital.
It's vital. You don't go out and vote, then you have little to nothing to say when things don't go your way. You know, make it an effort. To make an effort to be there, to get out and fill out this year, fill out that absentee ballot. They're sending it directly to your home. So your excuses are minimal to none to not have it filled out and sent back. They're sending it with an envelope for you to send it back in. You know, simple enough. But we gotta make it a point to, it is bad in minority areas because we do feel like we're not heard. And so we give up. With things like voting. No, your vote absolutely matters, and it could be the tipping point. You need to get yourself out and you need to go vote. And if we could see that in massive numbers by the end of this year, in a lot of ways, that will feel like a huge accomplishment. Because that's the building block, that's the foundation by which all of these things can begin to change.
Every vote matters. In the Kentucky General Assembly, where I serve in the House of Representatives, there were four races that were decided by less than 10 votes. There was one race decided by one vote. There's three votes. There's six votes. There's seven votes. I mean, literally, that can't get that point across strongly enough.
This summer feels like it's the opening of something. Like, I think that this is going to be a big start of more community involvement and local involvement and people just getting out to have their voices be heard on a local, state, and national level. Like, we don't have the best candidates for this national election for presidents, but I think, again, this is just the gate being open to further involvement by the young people in the future. It's important to get out and vote locally especially, statewide especially, and nationally, but it won't be just this election and then everything just gets better. It's continued involvement by everybody and taking accountability for your own future and for your kids' futures and so on and so forth that will actually change everything. And if we can keep that momentum that we have now going for multiple years, I don't know what could happen. It could be a lot of positive change, and it's good to see all the young people out here involved in this way, and I just hope it keeps going. I feel like that's the biggest thing right now, just this amount of young people being this excited about everything and this involved. In terms of direct stuff, I wrote down disproportionate minority contact, both locally and nationally. What I wrote down is that I worked at the Juvenile Detention Center for a little bit, and I did a lot of stuff before I even looked at it. Over 35% of juvenile arrests are Black, but Black people only make up 8% of the juvenile population. And how is that being addressed? Why is it still continuing when we know statistically and sociologically and criminologically through years and years of research that it's a thing, but it keeps on consisting? And there's the pipeline of recidivism, meaning the people going back to prison, people being arrested over and over again from juvenile detention centers to prisons. Why is there a pipeline being made at that young of an age? And why is it consisting over this many years of research, and we know it's a thing? Why hasn't it been addressed in a very direct way yet by policymakers? Why is the community not being up in arms about it because it's easy to find this stuff? Why is there not something being done when we know that such a small percentage of the country is being targeted by police and by judges at that aggressively disproportionate rate? Like, that's been a big thing to me since I was in college. When I learned that, it changed my whole perspective on everything. So I went to college wanting to be a detective, wanting to work for the FBI or something. And it completely, when my eyes got open to that, I completely switched courses, and here I am now. So it's It's the type of thing where if you actually have open eyes, you can see it. I don't see how you can be for it.
It's an arrest and a sentencing. It is not just simply an arrest, it's in the sentencing as well. A lot of times, you can have the exact same crime. They're parallel. They're twin, and then your white criminal gets off with a slap on the wrist, and you know what I'm saying. Then the black person is put in there for the rest of their lives off of a weed charge. You know, like it's unproportioned in sentencing as well. It's almost like you want to teach us a lesson. It's like, how is one made better than the other simply based off of race?
And we have an opportunity to do better next year in 2021 when your lawmakers go back. And, you know, I plan to lift up those voices and to work for smart justice reform across the aisle. Because, again, there are a lot of Republicans who are here for that work as well, and I'm proud to do it with them. No-knock warrants is something else I think we're going to be getting. No-knock warrants, murder of Breonna Taylor in her home because of a no-knock warrant has turned this into a national issue, and local governments have the power. City commissions in Louisville Metro Council is on the verge of banning no-knock warrants, but here it's Bowling Green City Commission. They have the power to ban them in our local area. I expect, as a member of the House Judiciary Committee, that we're going to be seeing legislation very soon, and I know I'll be co-sponsoring it, to ban no-knock warrants in the state of Kentucky.
So I got a question. So how do you feel about the information that even if it wasn't a no-knock warrant, how the officers were in regular clothes and decided to kick the door in, and how they're trying to tell the opposite story of that she was a drug kingpin and she was in it with her boyfriend and et cetera. I don't feel like that has anything to do with it. She still shouldn't have lost her life. But that's some of the information that like the police is giving.
Oh,
that,
absolutely.
You know, she was selling drugs through the, you know, her job and things like that, but she still lost her life if they didn't do what they did. So
yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Well, she was murdered, you know, plain and simple, and it was an atrocity that this has happened. But, you know, the people who are doing this work, you know, criminal justice advocates and advocates for racial justice made it very clear. The apparatus that allowed them to do this and the fact that this story did not come out for a while.
Because I think it happened in March.
Yeah, exactly.
It was my birthday.
Exactly,
birthday month,
yeah. And, you know, that's alarming, too, the fact that this was not a front page headline the next day, that it's been a slow story. But it speaks to the fact that having a no-knock warrant was, you know, the police used a tool that they had in their toolbox in order to do that. And that's why it's not a story. And, you know, you start there, you know, and I think there is incredible awareness now, and it's horrifying that it's taken the murder of a young woman in her own bed asleep to raise people's awareness that this could happen. And, you know, banning no-knock warrants at the local level, which is where it's starting in Louisville and where it would need to start here in Bowling Green with City Commission, that's the first step. And the state legislature also has the power. We come back in January, we can ban no-knock warrants. And again, I would hope this is something that everybody across the political spectrum could get on board with. For me, I'm coming from a position of being a racial justice, social justice, economic justice advocate. But if you're coming from a libertarian perspective, that's the apparatus of the state invading your home. So again, I would hope that across the spectrum, we can find that common ground and say, hey, you don't need these. Law enforcement does not need these. These, in this case and in other cases, I mean, as a historian, I'm always listening to the voices of the past, and I'm very cognizant of what I don't know. And what I don't know is how many stories are there like Breonna Taylor's? And that is not known to us. We need to know that. So then we really have evidence for why this is a good start. Banning no-knock warrants is a start. It's not a finish.
To return to the prison system and everything wrong with that in the U.S., the U.S. has over 2 million people that are either detained, incarcerated, or under state-sponsored slavery in some other way. Kentucky has a higher imprisonment rate than multiple countries. What's to be done, both locally, state-wise, and nationally, where that system of mass incarceration, largely for profit and free and cheap labor, isn't a thing that continues? Again, this has been consistent since for a very, very long time, and nobody's addressed
13th
it directly.
Amendment.
But yeah, it's been consistent for a very, very long time, and I think it's just now coming out that people are getting angry about this again.
Yeah.
Why are we locking away that many people in the land of the free, and why is it a consistent thing, and why is there a pipeline from juvenile to adult? Why are legislators and lawmakers not attacking that and thinking that that goes against the American dream? Because it should be against the quote-unquote American dream that we're incarcerating mass amounts of people, especially disproportionately minorities. That's just, it's strange to see. And why is it still going?
First and foremost, with being a criminology major, people are criminals, but I think the main objective is to get people rehabilitated.
It should be rehab,
They're
exactly.
They're not being rehabilitated.
That gap in funding, the bad priorities in funding, comes out way worse when we can have a fully militarized police unit in Louisville beating the hell out of people. But we can't afford good books for our schools. We can't afford internet. We can't afford stuff for our hospitals. Like, we're taking away funding from colleges, but we can give riot gear to the police to beat the hell out of citizens that are peacefully protesting. It's just obvious. It's really obvious. We're not saying abolish the police, but there's places that are saying abolish the police. We're not even saying abolish the police. We're saying take away money that they don't need and give it to people that need it. And that shouldn't be a big issue. That shouldn't be a big thing that we're having to go out and get beat up and risk our lives for, but we are. And no, I'm fully behind it.
We had talked about police training, that there were some places that were, it was alarming. You had to train more hours to be a waitress than you did. You had to put in more efforts to anything that you want to do professionally, you would assume would have to take time and effort. You don't just walk into a university and graduate tomorrow. You have to go to class and take the time and work for years, and for some people, past that 4-year, 5-year mark to obtain that degree. So why is it that within a matter of months, you're able to go out into the world with a badge and a gun? I need you to take your training more seriously. And that's in the department though. That's a requirement by which the department has to have standards. I'm not saying that that's necessarily in Bowling Green, but I'm saying around the world, there should be a particular standard that has to be met by all police force in all 50. Then if you want to add on extra learning situations, then that's on that state or that county but there needs to be a level standard. And it's too many that use the excuse of defense, and then you go back and you find out they didn't really have no real training, you know, so they shouldn't have even been out there in uniform. They haven't been trained to go that far. That matters, and I think that would change the narrative in a lot of situations. If we know that you have proper training and that you still didn't follow the training in which you met. Oh, okay, now I've got you.
Now qualified immunity. That's what a lot of officers get.
Yeah, now I've got you because I went back and I realized that this is the training process that you went through and you didn't follow the steps. You didn't follow the rules in which you were given. So, no, we're not gonna just let you off because you got a badge. I'm going to hold you accountable for your actions, and you need to go to jail just like you sent so many countless other people to jail. You need to be in there as well.
We've talked to Commissioner Brown about several demands. The mayor is getting some demands from us by the beginning of next week. I feel like there's a lot. I know that there has to be three votes, whatever we send, that three people in the city commission have to vote on it. So not really knowing a lot of the politicians, I mean, a lot of them are out there. Like I said, a lot of them I've heard and seen that it looks good on paper. It looks good for the camera that they're out there. But on Monday morning, when those demands come across that table, I don't really know if that person is going to be the one that puts a vote down for it.
I know.
Let's see. Some of them was if any officer has three or more disciplinaries, they should be fired. If the body cam is turned off in any way, it should be charged. I know they got something that they can charge it every time they go out. But if a body cam is turned off, it should either be administrative leave or fired, because that's evidence. You're destroying evidence by not having it on or turning it off or whichever way it goes. Training with the police, police reform, open up unsolved murders. I know in the black community that's big. There's a lot of unsolved murders from 10 years ago that hasn't been solved, but they feel as if BGPD takes drug cases serious, but not murders. The no-knock warrants, of course. And that's all we got so far.
And it was
what else was it?
The supervision.
Oh yeah.
So if you're a supervisor, if you hold a higher position,
police, mayor,
you have set number of people working under you, and collectively they have a set number of
disciplinaries
of disciplinary issues. You need to step down. Obviously, you cannot handle your team, and you need to have a seat. And start over.
People in the community would know more about the officers than a lot of the times their superiors would, in terms of how they actually behave. But I think it'd be a good thing to have a good set of people on a citizen review board looking over not even necessarily cases, but acts of officers not behaving in the way that they should be.
To my knowledge, they have a citizen review board.
They brought it up to me a few times.
I don't know that it meets in the way in which it should.
So that's the difference.
Right.
I don't have something that does meaningful.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then, but to my knowledge, there is a review board. I just don't know that they always do what they should be doing, or like State Representative mentioned, not just lip service, but actually coming together and fighting for themselves at that point. You're not just fighting for the people who live next door to you, but you're fighting for your own family. So who's going to fight more for your own family than you? It should be you.
Well, it's a complicated list of demands, and again, it speaks to where your values are. But this is a grassroots movement that's happening in Bowling Green, and your local officials, your mayor, your city commission, those are your grassroots lawmakers, and this is a conversation that needs to happen, and people come together. Lawmakers at the local level need to listen to what the concerns are of the people in their community and reach agreement on meaningful action. And if they can't reach agreement, well, you know, this is an election year.
We've been speaking with local community activists about where they feel their protests go from here. You're listening to WKU Public Radio.